is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. As the big day approaches, today we're zooming in on the largest non-white voting demographic this election season, the Latino community. We all know this group of 32 million voters is the furthest thing from a monolith, but there's a movement that's aiming to redefine the community and elevate the voices that have previously been left out of the conversation.
I'm an immigrant from Brazil and a green card holder for more than a decade now. Brazilians seldom identify as Latino-Latina, which for us tends to be associated with Spanish speakers, while Brazilians speak Portuguese. So I never identified as Latino, but funnily, since I heard the term Latinx, I've started identifying as Latinx, not only because of the non-binary X, but also because it represents to me an opening to include several complex immigrant identities, such as mine. I love Latinx.
That's one of many messages we got in our inbox about the term Latinx. We'll get to that later in the hour, but first, let's dig into the data about these voters. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Jens Manuel Krogstad. He's a senior writer and editor at the Pew Research Center focusing on Latino trends. Jens, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So last month, you co-authored a Pew report about the makeup of the U.S. Latino population, including population size, ancestry, the breakdown of immigrant generations. Give us an overview.
Well, we found there are more than 60 million Hispanics living in the United States today, and that's up from about 50 million in 2010. We see growing shares of Hispanics with college experience. We also see a growing share of Hispanics who speak English proficiently and a declining share who speak Spanish at home. We continue to see, in terms of origins, that Hispanics of Mexican origin account for a majority of all Hispanics in the U.S. They accounted for over 60% of Hispanics in this country. Yet we are seeing fast growth in among other origin groups, in particular Venezuelans, Dominicans, Guatemalans, and Hondurans have seen fairly fast growth since 2010.
Now, one of the latest polls from Pew compares voters' confidence in Joe Biden versus President Trump on key issues. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, we found that overall, Hispanics have more confidence in Joe Biden on a number of key issues, in particular his ability to handle the coronavirus outbreak, his ability to bring the country closer together, his ability to make good decisions about foreign policy, handle issues of law enforcement, and make good decisions about economic policy. On all of these issues, roughly 2/3 or more of Hispanic registered voters said they were confident in Joe Biden to handle these issues. And the share of Hispanics who are confident in Biden has increased since June. By contrast, when we asked Hispanic voters how they feel about President Donald Trump, about his ability to handle these issues, significantly lower shares of Hispanics said so. For example, about 1/3 of Hispanic registered voters said they had confidence in President Trump to handle the public health impact of the coronavirus outbreak.
Now, how does this compare to polling from previous elections? There are plenty of experts who say it's not useful to survey this group as a bloc because of its size and diversity.
We have found fairly consistent views among Hispanic voters in terms of their partisan identification and their voting behavior. For example, this year we found that about 63% of Hispanic voters say they prefer or lean toward Joe Biden versus 29% who said they would vote for Donald Trump. And in 2016, we found that 66% of Hispanic voters cast a ballot for Hillary Clinton versus 28% who voted for Donald Trump. And so we've seen these consistent ratios about for every 2 Hispanic voters who prefer the Democratic candidate, about 1, a little less than 1, prefer the Republican candidate. We've seen these trends be fairly consistent over time.
Now, you also explored how Latinos primarily identify themselves as Hispanic, the term you're using, Latino, American, or from their country of origin. What do these surveys show?
How Hispanics or Latinos identify themselves is a matter of personal preference. And we ask about this in a couple different ways, in a few different ways in our surveys. We found when we asked Latinos, do you prefer to refer to yourselves by your country of heritage, for example, Mexican or Cuban, or as Hispanic or Latino, or as American, about half say they prefer their country of heritage. So that's their most frequent response. Another roughly 40% say they prefer Hispanic or Latino. And 14% say they prefer the term American. And we see slightly different patterns, when you ask it a different way, when you ask people whether they prefer Hispanic or Latino, we actually find that about half say they don't have a preference, and then a larger share say they prefer Hispanic over Latino.
Are there any generational trends that you can tease out?
We do see some differences by immigrant generation. We see that as Hispanics, their immigrant roots become more distant, we do see that Hispanics tend to prefer terms like American, and even some decide not to identify as Hispanic.
I want to talk about the identity label Latinx, because Pew surveyed Latino adults and found that only a small number, 3%, actually use it. Tell us more about how that term is being used.
Latinx is an emerging pan-ethnic term for Hispanics or Latinos, and it reflects this growing global movement to introduce gender-neutral nouns and pronouns. And we found in our recent survey that 76% of Latinos said they had not heard of the term Latinx. Another 20% said they had heard of Latinx but don't use it, and about 3% say they use it. It is growing in use, especially we see it in news coverage, entertainment outlets, corporations, universities. So it is growing in use, but we still find relatively few Latinos are either using it or have heard of it.
Well, as we said at the top, this group is not a monolith. What do you think gets overlooked or misunderstood most?
That's a good question. I think just the reasons for the diversity of the Latino population. We have a variety of immigrant backgrounds. We have Latinos who are immigrants, some who are children of immigrants, some who have more distant immigrant roots, and others speak primarily English or primarily speak Spanish or maybe are bilingual. Others maybe have different political views, and how all these things come together and influence their worldviews is interesting and something that we study.
That's Jens Manuel Krogstad, a senior writer and editor at the Pew Research Center. Jens, thanks for your time.
Great. It was great to be here. Thanks.
Coming up, we'll go beyond the data and hear from folks who are redefining what it means to be part of the Latino community. We'll also talk about the term Latinx. One listener emailed, as a Spanish speaker in my 50s, I find the word grating and obnoxious. We have a perfectly good gender-neutral term, Latin. I work in a government institution and I feel obligated to use Latinx in outreach to the community. I see this term as a sort of linguistic colonialism, saying, let's fix your language since you don't know any better. And Cesaro emailed saying, as a Mexican born in the 60s, I do not self-identify as Latinx, but in the last 5 years, I have started using the term. The wonderful thing about it is that the younger folks who are inclusive and mindful of non-binary or gender-neutral language continue to identify their Latin American ancestry. I'm Jen White. We'll be back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. Google's free tools are designed to help millions of businesses around the country adapt to a new way of working. From updating their business hours to switching to curbside pickup to activating online booking, small businesses are staying connected to their customers with Google. They can even add gift card and donation links on Google so they can get support from their community. Explore Google's free tools for small businesses at google.com/grow.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers. You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Voting is crucial. And I don't give a damn how you look at it.
Is this a man?
It was we, the people.
The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Not we, the white male citizens.
Misrepresentative Democracy.
A new series about voting in America from NPR's Throughline.
Listen now.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're talking about the Latino community ahead of the presidential election. Of course, about 28 million people have already cast their votes. Joining us now from Brooklyn is Paola Ramos. She's a host and correspondent for Vice and Vice News. She's also former deputy director of Hispanic media for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Her new book is called Finding Latinx: In Search of the Voices Redefining Latino Identity. Paola, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before the break, we heard from a Pew editor about a recent study that shows only 3% of Latino adults use the term Latinx. But first, I want to talk about the origin of Latinx. Where did it come from?
Right. So you start seeing the word pop up in around 2004, right, in these online circles where you mostly see queer Latino folks using that X, right? And the X back then was a way to be more inclusive, right, to find a non-gendered word. Obviously, the Latino, Latina, like the Spanish language is gendered, right? The way we got here is because in Hispanic, knowing the word Hispanic, that was coined by Republicans in the Nixon administration, is Hispanic comes from Hispania, right? And so for many folks, that goes and ties our community to colonialism, right? To the European conquistadores. There, after in the 70s and the 80s, you see folks that start using Latino or Latina to sort of push back and be proud in these like in gendered words, no? Latinas. We're very much using that word symbolically. And then, as I mentioned, in the early 2000s, you start seeing this like queer movement. The problem, though, and one of the reasons why it is so controversial is because it's going beyond a queer word. No, it's going beyond a non-gendered word. Suddenly, you have many people that don't simply identify as queer. You know, you have Afro-Latinos, you have indigenous folks, you have people like, you know, my own grandparents and my father that are starting to use the word. And that's why I think it's so controversial, right? Because we're in this defining moment of understanding, like, what the word means. And that's why I think we're having these discussions where people are a little bit threatened from that X, and it's interesting to understand why.
Well, let's talk about the majority of the Latino community that says it either doesn't use the term Latinx or hasn't heard of it. Many of you who fall into this category reached out to us.
This is Anna from Austin.
Hi, my name is Amanda. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
My name is Andres from Richmond, Virginia.
I strongly dislike Latinx. It sounds very contrived. It's even hard to pronounce.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. Basically, because the Spanish language has those two variations, you know, some things are male and some things are female, but it's a grammatical inclusion. It's not a problem from the point of view of understanding the word.
With Hispanic and Latino, a lot of the stigma can be erased if we take back the word, rather than always creating a new word every time that we feel uncomfortable.
We're taking politically correctness to an extreme. Some languages have gendered nouns, and the fact that English does not should not mean we get to impose rules on other languages.
Thanks to Anna from Austin, Amanda from Atlanta, and Andre from Richmond for sharing their thoughts. Paola, your book, Finding Latinx, is in part an exploration of community, but it's also a journey inside yourself, and you frame it as a coming out story. Explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I overheard one of the comments that you had, right? Someone said, I believe he was Brazilian, he said Latinx just felt right, no? It felt right without truly knowing what it meant. I had a very similar experience. I felt like growing up You know, I grew up between Florida and Europe. My parents separated. My dad is Mexican. My mom is Cuban. And so I grew up hopping around, right? Hopping around the United States and Europe, where my mom migrated from Cuba. And then when I was in the States, sometimes I felt more Mexican depending on where I was. Others, I felt more Cuban. When I would travel to Mexico to see my family, I didn't feel Mexican enough. I grew up watching, you know, my father is a newscaster. He goes on Univision every day. The beauty standards that I grew up with, right, around what a Latina had to look like and what beauty meant, I never felt that. I remember then, you know, being in my early 20s and being in politics in D.C., and I would go into the sort of Hispanic meetings and Hispanic reunions, and I also didn't feel like I quite fit in. I felt like I couldn't be queer in those spaces, right? And I, if I had to be Latina, I had to speak in Spanish. And so all this to say that suddenly when Latinx started popping up, I felt like I did not have to choose between all my different hats, no? Mm-hmm. I felt like I could be queer in one word, and I could be Latina, and I could be a woman, and I could be someone that, you know, comes from a Mexican and a Cuban father, but suddenly has a very thick Spanish accent when I speak Spanish. And that sort of multifaceted version of myself that I didn't feel like I could bring in one, that came out in the Latinx word. And so a lot of the book, you know, a lot of my journey through the book is trying to understand how people, in their own way, not just being queer and coming out as queer, but coming out as Black and Latina, coming out as, you know, folks that speak indigenous languages, coming out as folks that want more rights than those that were given to their parents. Like, that is a coming out story.
We reached out to you to ask if you use the term Latinx to identify yourself. And here's what a few of you left in our inbox.
My name is Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez. I'm calling from Brooklyn.
My name is Marisela from Brooklyn.
My name is Erica, and I'm from Fairfax County, Virginia.
Latinx to me represents a gender-neutral coalition of all peoples under the ethnic group, also known as Latino.
I am a Latina woman. I'm married. I have a child. I am a straight woman. And I believe that the term Latinx is fair to those who are non-binary or non-gender conforming.
Oftentimes, the word Latino can tend to be very specific to a male patriarchal approach at looking at our population. Latinx is more inclusive and is also more understanding that our community goes beyond the male and female gender. I am proud to be Boricua, and I'm also proud to be Latinx.
Thanks to Ricardo from Brooklyn, Marisela from Brooklyn, and Erica from Fairfax County for those messages. Well, I want to bring a couple of other voices into the conversation. Joining us now is Danjeli Rodriguez del Orbe. She's a writer, spoken word artist, and community organizer based in Los Angeles. Danjeli, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And also with us from New York City is Daphne Frias, a young activist and medical student at Johns Hopkins University. Daphne, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, Danjeli, you're featured in Finding Latinx, talking about navigating your identity as an Afro-Latina from the Dominican Republic. As you grew up and then came to the U.S., what was your sense of how much you belonged in the Latino community?
I mean, when I was in the Dominican Republic, we didn't really use the word Latinx or Latino or Hispanic. There was really no need. We were all just Dominicans, right? And whoever was kind of like an immigrant to the Dominican Republic really had to identify themselves as something other than. I began to hear the word Latino, Hispanic when I migrated at 8 years old. And it was everywhere on TV, at school, in census. I generally remember being very young and helping my mother with the census and like not really understanding what we were supposed to check off, right? So I didn't really come into Latinidad or into an understanding of Latino, Hispanic until I migrated in 2003.
Now, Daphne, I understand you were born with cerebral palsy. How did that impact your sense of belonging in your community? Were your accessibility needs addressed?
So I believe that in general, in the Latinx community, the idea of disability is often seen as sort of a death sentence, and the minute that you're diagnosed with something other than quote-unquote normal, people sort of see you differently. And to this day, you know, my great-grandparents and my grandparents, I continuously have conversations that, you know, I'm not just going to get up and walk one day or, you know, that me being a medical student isn't a miracle, that these things should be normalized within our community for those of us who have disabilities. And oftentimes when my mother and I were navigating through the public school process here in New York City, where I'm born and raised, instead of being seen for trying to get my disabled accommodations, I was first trying to break through the barriers of being a young Latina, trying to, you know, achieve equitable education. So there was various layers to my identity that sort of compounded to create a viewpoint or an outward viewpoint of myself that was often difficult to dismantle, and continues to be a point of discussion in my work and in my life, and trying to normalize the fact that disabled Latinas can be successful.
That's New York-based activist Daphne Frias. Also with us, Dangeli Rodriguez del Orbe, a writer and community organizer based in L.A., and Paula Ramos, host and correspondent for Vice and Vice News. She's also the author of Finding Latinx. And we're talking about the future of Latino identity. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
I'm Rodney Carmichael. And on this episode of Louder Than a Riot, did bias against rap lyrics seal the fate of No Limits Mac Phipps?
This guy shouldn't be incarcerated. And I know that his music got him incarcerated, but they got the wrong guy.
Listen now to the Louder Than a Riot podcast from NPR Music.
Now let's get back to our conversation with Paula Ramos, host and correspondent for Vice and Vice News and the author of Finding Latinx, New York-based activist Daphne Frias, and Dangeli Rodriguez del Orbe, a writer and community organizer based in L.A. Jorge emailed saying, if people want to label themselves Latinx, it's fine with me. Just don't impose those labels on those of us who don't want it. I identify myself as Mexican, since that is where my parents are from. And Sandra writes, I don't identify that way because I use she, her, ella pronouns. But if I'm talking about a group of us Latinx people at work or referring to someone who is non-binary, gender expansive, then yes, I'll use Latinx. And Norma writes on Facebook, I am Hispanic, I am Latina, period. I want to play a clip from a conversation we had earlier this year with Ilia Calderon, a news anchor for Univision, who happens to be an anchor alongside your dad, Paola, Jorge Ramos. And here's part of what she told us about the racism she experienced as an Afro-Latino from Colombia.
Racism is a part of the upbringing in the families. Those microaggressions have been part of the Latino culture forever. About the hair, about the preference for the lighter skin. When the grandmas or great grandmas or the mothers tell the girls, marry a white guy because we need to make or create a better race, for the race to be better, for the kids not to have the curly hair. It's something that we need to recognize and we need to address. We need to bring that conversation to our tables, and we need to start eradicating racism.
Dangeli, what's your reaction to what we just heard? Does Ilia's story resonate with you?
Definitely. And we saw it everywhere growing up, you know. I heard family members who also said, you know, you have to marry lighter than you so that you can better the race, right? I heard the microaggressions on hair. I was as young as 4 years old when they started straightening my hair so that I could already fit under certain beauty standards. And I did not grow up with any representation of Black Latinas on TV. All the novelas, all the shows, all the kids show were all white Latinos, white Latinx folks, right? So for a long, long time, I looked for someone who looked like me in these like big media outlets, and I didn't have any, right? And after coming to the U.S., I kind of lived in a bubble of Dominicanidad in New York, where a lot of people looked like me. But when I moved to the West Coast, I realized that Black Latinos have not received the representation needed for other even Latinx folks to be aware of our existence. What I encountered a lot in the West Coast was a lot of blatant racism, where people were completely unaware that, like, asking me how I learned Spanish, even though I was born in Dominican Republic, directly spoke about the ignorance behind race and ethnicity, right? Not really understanding that you can be Black and at the same time be Latinx. And not because I have, you know, an African-American parent and, let's say, Mexican parent, but rather because when I was born in the Dominican Republic in a Latin American country. So a lot of these things, and you can even argue that the term Latinx in itself, or Latino, Hispanic, when it came about, that it was a direct reflection of wanting to appease to a white gaze, right? To want it to be understood by white people, right? To understand or to have a presence in the United States that really encompasses Latin America. But a lot of those folks that were Black, that were indigenous, were erased during that conversation.
Paola, you spoke with several Afro-Latino folks for your book. Why are Black Latinos so often left out of the conversation of what it means to be part of this community?
I mean, that wasn't up to me to answer. No, that's exactly why I talked to folks like Ilia Galderon and I spent time with her. That's exactly why I wanted to fly. As Danieli is explaining this, that's exactly why I wanted to embed with her, right? Because when I read about Danieli, when I read about her story, it was towards the end of my journey. It was after I had spent time with Ilia. It was after I had spent time with, like, Afro-Mexican activists in Mexico. After time, I had spent a lot of time with different voices within the community, but I felt like Danieli, in a way, embodied many different stories in her, no? I remember reading about her, and in her, it was a story of being undocumented and Black and navigating the systems and systems of beauty. But part of the reason why I wanted to spend time with her is because through her, I understood that, as she just explained, who you are in the East Coast, no? You're accepting Blackness in the East Coast is very different from how you're perceived in the West Coast, right? And as someone that I personally had grown up with my father's Mexican narrative, no, with the Mexican story, I wanted to see what it felt like to be Danieli in LA, right? And in the city that took in my father. And so I remember the first time I met her, Danieli, you may remember, but I remember I walked into UCLA and I was late, but I walked into a classroom and there was about like 20 students, 20 young Mexican summer camp students. And Danieli was in the front of the class. And every single one of them was staring at her. Mm-hmm. And the story that Danieli was essentially saying was, look, immigrants also look like me. No, not everyone is brown. You can also be an immigrant and be Black and be Latino. And every one of them was simply staring because they had never seen that image, right? They had never understood the story of migration, not through borders, right? But through the story of someone like Danieli. And so I think, you know, that was part of why I wrote this book, so people could live through these voices and through experiences like Danieli's. And what's happening to her is happening to someone like Ilia Calderon in the newsroom in Miami, right? And that's why I wanted to go to the newsroom with her and understand, like, what is it like to sit next to my dad every single day, right? And to succumb to certain standards, right? And to tell people to wear your hair a certain way. What does that feel like? Mm-hmm. And so that you know, that was the sort of the heart of the book.
Well, we got a message from Johan who writes on Facebook, I find the term Latinx ridiculous. I think it was coined by people who just don't know how to speak Spanish. I'm Venezuelan by birth, American by naturalization, and that makes me Latino. We also heard from Sylvia who tweets, I am U.S. Cuban and Latinx. I am fine with non-gendering the language. Choosing these identities is generational and political. My parents reject Latinx as Cuban refugees from the Castro regime. They are Republicans and conservative. I am neither. I am Latinx. Jeff says, as someone who speaks Spanish as a second language and who adopted Latinx early on, I find listening this morning that I've apparently been mispronouncing the word. Following in the traditional pronunciations of Latina and Latino, I've used Latinx. Is this wrong, Paola?
No, it's not wrong.
I mean, yeah, that's another part of the conversation. How do you even pronounce this word? It's not wrong. I mean, again, that part of it is also understanding, like, people like my brother, he barely speaks Spanish, right? He grew up in this country speaking English. You get to pronounce the word however you want. No, that is also part of understanding our community. No, we don't all speak Spanish. We have different accents. I say Latinx. You ask my dad, he'll say Latinx, I think it's okay.
Mm. Well, you know, not everyone you met shared the goal of being more inclusive. You dedicate an entire chapter to Latinos who've joined white supremacist groups like the Proud Boys. What was it like to come to terms with the fact that they, too, are part of this patchwork?
Yeah, I had a conversation with Enrique Tarrio. Enrique is currently the chairman of the Proud Boys, and many people are surprised to know that the chairman of the Proud Boys is actually an Afro-Cuban. And so I went into the conversation with, you know, my own biases. I already thought I knew how the conversation would end. I thought we were going to hate each other. And at the end of the day, it ended up opening my eyes a lot, and it was part of the exercise of understanding that X, right, of breaking my own stereotypes of what it means to be a Latino, and understanding that, yes, Latinos are also conservative, and yes, we can also perpetuate racism ourselves. And so when you see someone like Enrique Tarrio, who adores Donald Trump, you know, who you see him in the streets of Miami, you know, insulting people, I was about to write him off as simply that. But then you understand that this is someone, particularly in Miami, you know, in this battleground state that everyone seems to care about, but it is someone that has never been accepted by either party. No, it is someone that was disregarded by Republicans, right, because of who he is and what he represents, and he was someone that has been disregarded by Democrats, and he's someone that has been simply disregarded by the system. And so a lot of the trends that I found in Enrique are the same things that I just found in Arizona. I was just there a couple of days ago, and I've been finding it in Texas, where there is this movement, particularly of young Latino men, right, this increasing, it's slow, but it is increasing, of young Latino men that are extremely intrigued by Donald Trump. And the question is why, no? And I don't have all the answers, but what I am seeing is that there is this deep desire sometimes to forget that you are an immigrant. No, there is this deep desire to not be otherized. And anything that makes you, creates an illusion, right, that you can be as close as possible to white power, no, that you can assimilate to that American dream that was promised to you once, people run for that. No, people believe that. And that is what I saw in Enrique, right? And so instead of, I don't agree with anything, right? I find him an extremely problematic and dangerous person. But at the core of what's driving him to assimilate to this is a real problem among our community, right? And that is because there's been generations of us that have had to assimilate and have had to be sort of normalized this discrimination. And then people like Enrique will do anything as possible to forget where he comes from.
You know, we could spend another week on this conversation because it is so complex, but we've only got about a minute left. You know, big picture, when you zoom out and you think about the complexity of your community and people from the outside are looking in, what do you think it's most important for us to understand?
I think you heard it. I think Daphne said it perfectly. I think there is a young generation of Latinos that are sick of the status quo, right? That are sick of assimilating and normalizing and being told that they are this or that and being put in boxes. And so I think we're already seeing the change. And I call that a change of, like, coming out, right? And you're coming out in your different identities. You're coming out and understanding what true power means. You're coming out and understanding who you are. And I think we just have to be willing to listen and to ask questions that we've never asked, right, about who we are and what change, how we've changed over the past years. And so I think it starts with basic questions of asking the young people, how are you different from your parents? What do you want? What do you want change to look like? Surprisingly, I asked that question many times. Many told me they had never been asked that before. What type of change do you want? So let's start there.
That's Paola Ramos, a host and correspondent for Vice and Vice News and former deputy director of Hispanic media for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Her new book is called Finding Latinx in Search of the Voices Redefining Latino Identity. Also with us, Daniele Rodriguez del Orbe, a writer, spoken word artist, and community organizer based in LA, and Daphne Frias, a young activist and medical student at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks to you all. This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simon. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.